Good afternoon. First of all, thank you to the organizers for letting me speak here. And this afternoon, I'm speaking on the Perret-Tarrasch problem. How do I move the slides on this? The arrow keys?
You killed it. Move the page down.
Here? How do I change the page? Oh, maybe people just do it by mouse clicks. Oh, well, there's the second page anyway. The Perret-Tarrasch problem. Given integers, positive integers, n and k, with k less than or equal to n minus 1, this problem asks for two distinct subsets of the integers, say x1 through xn, y1 through yn, such that the sums of their powers are equal all the way up from 1 to k. And we write the solution in this way, and we say that n is its size and k is its degree. So, for example, here's a really elementary example. 1 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3 is equal to 10, and that's equal to 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 4, and their squares are equal as well. And a bit more numbers, their squares, cubes, fourth powers and fifth powers are equal as well. So the key thing here to note is that we're requiring distinct subsets, because this is what we need to exclude trivial solutions. So you can see here, if we add in a 20 on both sides to the above example, that just becomes trivial because it appears on both sides. So this is really sort of an old problem. It was first looked at by Perret in 1851, and then there was more work done on it by Tarry and Escott into the, I think, 1910, 1920. And if you look at Dixon's History of Numbers, History of the Theory of Numbers, there's a huge amount of special cases discussed in there, none of which are really particularly interesting. But the problem was really rediscovered by Wright in 1931, and a lot of the stuff that came out in that is still in his publication is still of interest today. So one thing that'll be important for later on is to note that the problem actually has some equivalent formulations. So the first one is saying about the sums of powers being equal. The second one is actually talking about if we take those sets, put them as roots of two different polynomials, and then subtract one polynomial from the other, the resulting polynomial is of a certain degree. And the final one is talking really about the order of the roots at z equals 1 of that polynomial. And you can see immediately, sort of from the second formulation, that the maximal interesting case is going to occur when k is equal to n minus 1. And we give that a special name. We call it ideal. So from the previous examples, and we see in the second formulation, that's going to give a polynomial of degree 1, 2x minus 5. And in the second example, it's going to give a polynomial of degree 0, negative 14,400. So yes, one thing that I'll point out here that will come up later is that's a highly composite number. So another thing to note is, assuming that we have a solution of some kind, basically any affine transformation with rational coordinates is going to give you another solution. So we'll say that any solutions that have this relationship between themselves, we'll say that they're equivalent, and otherwise we'll say they're inequivalent. So each solution gives rise to an infinite family of solutions. So really, we're looking for inequivalent solutions. Now, one thing that makes the PTE problem interesting is it's connected to two other problems in number theory, among others. And one is the Easier-Waring problem. And that asks for the smallest integer n, but we'll call it v of k, such that for all m, there exists integers x1 through xn, such that x1 sum through x1 to the k sum through x to the k xn to the k is equal to m for some combination of signs. So if you're familiar with the usual Waring problem, all these signs are normally all just pluses. But here we're allowing any possible combination of plus and minus. And one thing that's kind of weird about this is when they say easier, it's really being completely misnamed, because all the bounds for v of k are derived from the bounds for the usual Waring problem. And in fact, the best bound for arbitrary k for this problem is big O of k log k. But it's widely conjectured, and I guess some people believe, obviously, to be big O of k. But what's interesting here, the connection with the PTE problem, is that for small values of k, the best bounds derive from ideal solutions of the PTE problem. And in fact, the bounds that you get from this derivation are much better than those you get from the usual Waring problem. Now, another problem that has a connection with this is the Erdős-Székeres problem. And that's given n, you want to find positive integers alpha 1 through alpha n such that that product is minimized with respect to the L infinity norm. And in particular, you want to show that these minima grow faster than n to the beta for some positive constant beta. The connection with the PTE problem here is really twofold. For this collection of n, relatively small n, the minimizing sets that are found in the solution all give ideal solutions to the PTE problem of size n. But for larger n, 7, 9, 10, and 11, it's actually been shown that the minimizing sets you get cannot possibly lead to PTE solutions. So really, these are completely opposite facts in some respects. But for larger cases, nothing's known of the relationship between the two problems. This statement is a bit misleading. There is stuff known about the Erdős-Székeres problem for n up to and including 15. But beyond that, nothing's known about any aspect of the problem, really. So I've talked a little bit about the connections with the PTE problem and other problems, but what about the PTE problem itself? Well, in that original paper, Wright conjectured that it was always possible to find ideal solutions. But there hasn't been much progress on that in, I guess, the over probably around 75 years since that was done. For a really small n, complete parametric ideal solutions are known. Those are just elementary derivations. For n equals 6, 7, and 8, parametric solutions are known, but they're only known in an incomplete way. It's not known if they give you all solutions. And for n equals 10 and 11, in each case, there's infinite inequivalent families of solutions are known. But once again, they're incomplete. But what's really interesting here is that they don't come from elementary derivations like in the previous two situations. They actually both arise from rational points on elliptic curves. So for n equals 10, that was due to Smith from an elliptic curve of Letac from, I think, the 40s that was done. And then for n equals 10, that's a brand relatively new paper from Chowdhury and from Bolesky. Now, what our focus will be on today is more this last statement. For n equals 9 and 12, there's only two inequivalent solutions known. And these were all found computationally due to these groups of people here. And for n greater than 12, no ideal solutions are known. So we're clearly very far away from what Wright originally conjectured. I guess I should also point out, it's not known, say, for any n, whether there's provably no solutions. So people aren't even sure whether they exist or not for larger n. Now, what sort of got me interested in this is in 2007, Alpers and Tiedemann published a paper that addressed the PTE problem over different rings, over Z cross Z and the Gaussian integers. Their paper largely discussed Z cross Z, but they really only gave a small example, elementary example, of over the Gaussian integers. But when I saw that, I thought, to some extent, ideal solutions should be easier to find over the Gaussian integers because, you know, you have the square root of 1 in there. So I thought I'd look through all the results in the literature and see which ones carried over. And it turned out that all the facts we talked about, as well as other theorems from the literature, they generalize in an almost trivial way, not only to the Gaussian integers, but in fact to any ring of integers of a number field. But we'll just stick to the case where O is a unique factorization domain, so we can talk about GCDs. So I thought the next step for me was to look at the PTE problem over the Gaussian integers of size n greater than or equal to 9 using the computational methods of Boren et al. So to describe what I did, if you were to look at this problem of searching for solutions naively, what you might do is fix the solution size, solution space of up to size S, restrict all your xi and yi in there, and then because we can translate the solutions by a positive constant, we can assume x1 is 1, and then assume that the solutions have this ordering, and then really we pick a bunch, and then pick yn to be the sum of the xn's minus the sum of the yn's, and then you want to check, you check whether or not their sums of their powers were equal. But that's a pretty terrible way of doing it. But there's a much better way, and this is what Boren did. So I guess I should have left this up on the other board, but you remember how we had the difference of those two polynomials being of a certain degree. Well, in the ideal case, that difference was actually going to be a constant. So if we rewrite that difference like this, we can actually substitute yj into here for j equals 1 through n for x, because this is just a polynomial in x. And of course, the right-hand side disappears completely except for c. And then for any k between 1 and n, we can rearrange this equation, basically dividing through by the first n minus k plus 1 factors. And so we have this equation for j equals 1 all the way up to k. So if we already know, if we've managed to pick the first x1 through xn minus k plus 1 and y1 through yk, well, we're going to have k equations, and we're going to know everything on the far right-hand side. We're going to know that whole reciprocal product. So we've got k ordered pairs, yj and f of yj, and we can use our basic interpolation polynomials, Lagrangian polynomials, to find f of x formally. And then because f of x is a polynomial up here, you can see here it's a polynomial in yj, but its roots are going to be the xn minus k plus 2 all the way up to xn. So in order to find these, we just solve this polynomial numerically and find its roots. So we can repeat this process, get another polynomial, and then we do this to find the remaining yk plus 1 all the way up to yn. And already, instead of searching in 2n minus 2 variables, we only need to search in n plus 1 variables. So when it comes to implementing this, this is all really quick to do computationally, relatively speaking. The only part that's sort of hard is actually finding the zeros of this polynomial f of x. But of course, if you think about it, you don't need to find all the zeros. You just have to check to see if the first one is an integer. As soon as you know it's not an integer, you throw it out and you move on. So that doesn't take too long. And if it's close to an integer, then you check the other ones as well. But that sort of happens so rarely, you only really need to see whether or not it's close to an integer. But nevertheless, you still want to make that search more efficient. So one way of doing this, as I said, how we always have that constant associated with the ideal solutions. Given size, given the problem of size n, we really want to look at all the constants of all possible solutions and take the GCD of them and call that Cn and say it's associated with the problem over the ring of integers O. And this is why we wanted it over O to be a UFD, so that we'd be able to take the GCD over these. And then there's this really nice theorem of Boren saying that if we have a prime in that ring that divides Cn, then we can reorder the yi modulo that prime. And I'll save that slide. And oh well, whatever. It's saved up there, but it's not on these screens saved. All right. So anyway, that means we can reorder the solutions modulo Q. So when we're picking them out, we can actually pick them out in a much more efficient way. So if we suppose that Q1 and Q2 are the largest primes in that ring dividing our constant, well, we can assume the first solution is 0 again, and then we can pick the rest successively. So if we have xi, we'll pick yi so that it's congruent modulo Q1 to xi. And then we'll pick xi plus 1 so that this congruence is satisfied modulo Q2. And so the way it works out is that every prime Q that you have dividing the constant, that's going to reduce your search space by a factor of 1 over Q. So it's very important to find these factors dividing Cn in terms of these computational searches. So look, going back to the integral case, these are the results from the literature. So that Cn is divisible by n minus 1 factorial. It's also divisible, in this case, if p is greater than 3 and p is equal to n, and p divides Cn, and also in this case. So you can see already being divisible by n minus 1 factorial, that's going to make you pretty composite as that constant. And in fact, this is a full table. And on the lower bound for Cn, I've actually taken out the n factorial already, just to save writing down all those extra factors. So actually, this one is out of date. I haven't actually seen that paper where that's read. I've only read a review of it. But you can see even for, I guess, above 7, it's not clear what the actual upper bound is. There's still a gap between what the lower and upper bound is here. Now, what's great about those divisibility results from the literature about the integers is that I think I should mention here when I go back that these second two are due to Smith and Rees, but they both generalize to the ring of integers in, once again, like a relatively trivial way. So we also have this additional result as well, saying that if we already have a prime dividing Cn, then we can actually say what power of it divides Cn, or rather a higher power. But we can't so easily say, generalize the fact that n minus 1 factorial divides the constant. That's a bit more complicated. And really we need to know, look exactly at the ring that we're working over to decide that. It depends really on how the primes split, the rational primes split in that ring. And we actually only get divisibility if we have like an inert prime or it's primes of type 3. And we get it divisibility under this condition. So with that in mind, combining all those results gives us this table for divisibility. So you can see that at least in the larger cases, we're getting primes, I guess, of norm 17 appearing in here, which is kind of large. But at the same time, we don't get those nice n factorials in there anymore. So really, the constant is much smaller in the case of the Gaussian integers. So anyway, after doing all this work, I actually got around to implementing this. And so I'd written an algorithm that selects the Gaussian integers according to that method, manipulates them, computes the interpolation polynomial, and tests it to see if it has an integer roof. So I did that in Maple, and I mean, obviously it wasn't so fast, so to speed it up, it's been coded in C++ using the class library for numbers. And really the interpolation part and the manipulation is very fast. Almost all the time is spent trying to check that first root. So one thing that is really handy about this problem is that it's more or less trivially parallelizable. So if you pick that search space S, you can divide it up into intervals, assign each interval to a processor, and it's not even necessary for the processors to communicate. They just look for solutions within that interval, and then they can sort of report back to the program with the results. So currently I have these computations running on a cluster that has 16 nodes, each with 4 codes. But unfortunately, as of Monday when I prepared all this, the computations are still in progress, but the preliminary results agree with what's been done so far. And at this point, that's all I have to say. But here's the